Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday. It's June 10th. Currently, we've got 58 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 61 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Leslie. Good to see everybody. We've got nice weather to kick off the day, a little bit of cloud cover. We actually have a front that's working its way through the state from northern Utah towards the southeast corner today, and some lingering moisture across southeast Utah as well. So the front today mainly going to help drop temperatures a little bit, help cool things off from what we saw over the weekend with a scorcher of a day yesterday. So plan on partly cloudy skies into the afternoon with just a small chance of a shower or thunderstorm. Winds will be pretty light, becoming northwesterly into the afternoon behind the front as well. The drop in temperatures is pretty short-lived, so we'll see upper 70s in Park City today, partly cloudy in Heber City, mid-80s expected for highs. Could see a stray shower or storm as well. Not a huge threat. Best chances, I think, of moisture is going to be the south of us. But high pressure then builds back in as we get into Tuesday, Wednesday. In fact, this next heat wave should bring temperatures similar to what we saw last week, with mid-80s expected across Park City by Wednesday. So 81 is expected to be the high on Tuesday, overnight lows in the low 50s. Then we're climbing to the mid-80s by Wednesday and Thursday. Now, there is some good news. A storm system that's hanging out to the desert southwest is going to move in through Friday. It'll bring some clouds, drop our temperatures again, and bring a chance of some showers and thunderstorms. So a high of 78 is expected on Friday with a chance of storms, and then clearing out for the weekend. And we're going to hang out in those mid to upper 70s for highs in Park City. For Heber, plan on highs topping out at about 93 on Wednesday. We'll drop to 92, so not much difference Thursday before falling into the 80s by the weekend. Again, a chance of showers and thunderstorms with partly cloudy skies on Fridays expected. Leslie?
All right. Thanks, Nate.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, Mo Hickey is the CEO of Voices for Utah Children. Martin Munoz is the Voices for Utah Children's Kids Count Director. They'll discuss the results of this year's Kids Count National Data Book that was released just this morning. And Park City Education Foundation CEO Ingrid Whitley, along with Vice President of Advancement Jen Bella, will be in. We'll have an update on the success of Running with Ed and how that money was spent with this year's classroom grants. Well, taking a look at some local news now. Paid parking or trailhead reservations may be coming to Park City's Bonanza Flat Conservation Area. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports the City Council wants more time to evaluate options for the open space in the heart of the Wasatch.
In the years since Park City purchased the 1,500 acres that make up Bonanza Flat with the help of local taxpayers, the area has grown in popularity as a summer recreation destination. To deal with the congestion, the Trails and Open Space Department recommended several management strategies to the City Council Thursday, including increased shuttle service to Bonanza Flat and potentially adding paid parking kiosks or a reservation system. Utah Open Lands Director of Conservation Emily Ingram said a paid system could help encourage more sustainable behavior.
The paid parking system would really be targeted for, would it be a fee per vehicle or per visitor? And really we'd be aiming to access or to control some of the access issues and discourage specific behaviors. So we're encouraging transit to trails, we're encouraging people to carpool, we're discouraging people from driving a single occupancy vehicle up there.
Park City started the transit to trail service in 2021. There were talks Thursday of increasing the frequency of the free service that takes hikers and mountain bikers from downtown Park City up to Bonanza Flat. More trailheads across Big Cottonwood Canyon, which connects directly to Bonanza Flat, will begin charging fees over the next year as part of a new U.S. Forest Service initiative. Councilmember Jeremy Rubel said Park City doesn't want to be in the position of having the only free parking in the area.
If we know it's coming and we know we're going to have to do it and we know we have a problem to address, let's give direction to start down that path of answering those questions and doing that work. We don't need to necessarily put a kiosk in tomorrow. So let's start the process, right? Like with purpose.
Rubel suggested finalizing a plan by the 2025 trail season. The council agreed that taking time to come up with the best system is worth the wait. Bonanza Flat user data collected over summer 2023 found that Park City residents made up just 7% of visitors. Salt Lake City locals made up the largest portion at 25%. The data also shows that most visitors stay in Bonanza Flat for less than 45 minutes. If paid parking does become reality, Rubel expressed support for prioritizing Park City residents because they're paying for the $25 million bond that helped purchase Bonanza Flat. That could mean waiving parking fees or giving residents priority access to reservations or shuttle seats. Fellow council member Ed Parisian agreed.
I want to give the locals that are paying for this land the absolute first dibs on everything, free, whatever. Always the benefit.
During public comment, Summit County resident Shauna Hopperstead asked if the council would think about also giving county residents a discount on any potential future fees.
It just seems like paid parking is just going to make it more difficult, especially for those of us who are now in our retirement years, trying to get out and minimize costs. So it would be appreciated if you would strongly consider that.
Currently, Bonanza Flat still has quite a bit of snow. It's expected to be ready for hikers in July. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with an upcoming event. You're partnering with the Skin Cancer Foundation for free skin cancer screenings?
Yeah, this coming weekend. It's an event that we're excited about. It's one of the events that is really needed based on some of the recent data around skin cancer. You know, Utah has the highest rate of melanoma in the nation. It almost double the rate of, or the national rate of 21.8 per 100,000. So roughly 22 cases per 100,000 of melanoma. We double that in Utah at 42. Where it becomes concerning or even maybe alarming is we're three times the national average in Summit County at 60 per 100,000. So when we look at this, we're seeing an increased rate of melanoma or skin cancer. We want to make sure that individuals have an opportunity to be looked at by a professional to determine if they have anything that might be of concern that they might want to have addressed through a dermatologist. In Summit County, the greatest risk is based on the data that we have available is those males 65 plus, where we see an alarming rate of 230 cases per 100,000 in those men 65 plus. That is 2.5 times greater the risk than the women of that same age group that are just 96.3. Now, when I say just, that's still a concern, but when you start to see stark differences like that between genders, we want to make sure that we're bringing awareness to this issue, but not just raising the issue, having an opportunity for people to address it. So this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at our building at 650 Round Valley Drive, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. all 3 days, the Skin Cancer Foundation is offering mobile skin cancer screenings. No appointment needed. Your insurance status doesn't matter. Your age doesn't matter. You can pull up. Appointments are on a first-come, first-served basis. They're going to have physicians that speak both English and Spanish available in private rooms that you can go in and ask questions, have things looked at, receive a screening, and really understand the risks associated with melanoma.
And melanoma, though, is only one type of skin cancer, though, right?
Right, it is. That's exactly right. It is the most concerning and with the most severe outcomes. And that's why when we talk about skin cancer, we focus on melanoma. Is if you're being screened for melanoma, which is the most severe, generally you're going to capture the other types of skin cancer as well during that screening.
Mm-hmm. And what should people look for? And I know melanoma kind of hides in the most obscure places too, right? In your scalp and places that you may not even be able to see on your body.
Yeah, and this is something that's impacted our family directly is skin cancer and melanoma. And to be honest, Leslie, I don't know what to look for. And that's why we're offering this clinic is we would never want somebody to think that they were able to diagnose or address a melanoma other than a professional, a dermatologist, somebody that is very skilled, highly trained in this field, which is why a free clinic is a great way for somebody to go and have something looked at, or if there's something of concern, those professionals are going to be the best way for you to learn about that.
Yeah, and what can you tell us about just these high numbers in Utah? Is it just being out in the sun?
I think, yeah, it's absolutely out in the sun. It's related to sunburns, tanning, elevation, exposure. You know, this is a very active community. We're at high elevation. We enjoy beautiful days like this morning where it's a bluebird sky and the temperatures are a little bit cooler. So we hop on our mountain bike, we go for a run, we go for a walk, and maybe don't throw some sunscreen on. We go and sit at a soccer game or a baseball game and don't think about it. It's only an hour. We're just going to be outside an hour. I'm as guilty as anybody. I got sunburned this weekend at a soccer tournament for my son. And here I am reporting on melanoma with sunburned legs. So it just takes an extra second to apply some sunscreen. They're going to have sunscreen available at the event. And really protect yourself from that exposure to the sun throughout the day.
Okay, people register on the website?
No registration needed. Just show up. First come, first serve basis. They've got, I think, 3 exam rooms in their mobile bus, all private. So 10 to 4, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Of course, Sunday is Father's Day. With these rates in males 65 plus, it might be a great way to help your dad, the dad in your life, or the men in your life, recognize the risk of melanoma and get out there and have them looked at real quick.
So is this at a cost to the health department?
This is a partnership between us. We were notified of this opportunity through our partners at Park City Municipal. We appreciate that. But the only cost to the health department is just the space in our parking lot, which we're more than happy to do.
All right. Let's see. You've also wrapped up the community health assessment. What did you find out?
Well, we haven't wrapped it up. We just kicked it off. Just a few weeks back, and this community health assessment is in the mind of a public health professional and those of us at the health department the most important assessment that we do every 3 to 5 years. And what this does is sets a baseline for data that are used to direct and allocate resources moving forward. So the plan is to continue having this available through early fall, and it's available online, both in English and Spanish. It's available in paper form in English and Spanish at the health department. And we also have kiosks set up at all 3 of our locations in English and Spanish, where you can go and individuals that are waiting for services either at any of our 3 locations can take that community health assessment. What's unique about our community health assessment is this is the first one that we've done post-COVID. We had completed one right before we went into the pandemic, so we have some pre and post data on how the pandemic may have affected us locally. But we've also included elements of climate change in this community health assessment and helping understand the perceived risks among our community so that we can help build a more resilient community as it relates to those changing climates and weather patterns that we plan to experience.
So where would people then fill this assessment out?
Well, I'd love them to visit our brand new website. The web address is the same, summitcountyhealth.org. The website is a work in progress. We've launched the new website, but we're intending that website to become the communication hub for all things public health in Summit County. And the right on the front page of that site is the community health assessment. You can't miss it. There's a link under there that's in Spanish, so that if it's a Spanish-speaking individual that feels more comfortable with their native language in Spanish, they can take it there. It's been translated by native speakers at the health department, so it's easy to understand. It should take about 10 to 15 minutes, and it is an important survey for us locally, but it's also an opportunity for locals and those visiting to share with us their concerns about public health and really what's keeping them up at night.
And when will you wrap it up?
We will have this wrapped up by late October, early November, and then the plan is to have it presented to our Board of Health in the 1st of December, and then make the tour with our County Council, Park City Council, the councils on our east side, to present the information as we see fit, and then, or not, excuse me, as it becomes available, and then preparing for the Community Health Improvement Plan, the CHIP, so we have the CHA and the CHIP, but the Improvement Plan for 2025, and that's really where we begin to see a focus on those elements that national data don't necessarily provide.
So do the results of this then have some budgetary impacts? Because again, the budget, right? The budget gets approved mid-December, so
yeah.
Don't you need to have those requests in before then?
This will have budgetary impacts moving into the 2026 budget after we've completed the Community Health Improvement Plan. We would be a bit remiss if we didn't have a strategy or a plan going into a budget season, and being that we're going to still be gathering data and that those data will be fairly raw. It's going to take a little bit of time to get it into a format that's usable and is also tangible for our elected officials. So once that plan is available, not only will we be looking at our local needs, but it'll give us opportunities and really specific relevant data to apply for more federal grants and help improve our funding ratio there at the health department.
Okay, and what is it that you want to find out?
Is everything a good answer? That's what we're really after. The questions are pulled from a national database, so they're validated questions. They're not just things that the staff at the health department made up. But we want to know, obviously, the traditional public health data and those things that we are bread and butter for the health department. But we also want to get outside of the norms. We want to know related to climate change and how people are feeling about climate change. We want to know about individuals and how they feel about diversity and equity and inclusion and areas where the health department has succeeded. And then, of course, those areas where maybe we've fallen a bit short or areas where they feel there's improvement needed. When we take local data like this that's organically driven from the community, compare that to national data and state data, and then through that comparison, see where the differences are or where the gaps are, it becomes more powerful in how we address issues here locally and keeps us in that range of Utah's healthiest county and really make sure that we're serving our local community the way that we should be serving them rather than what national data tells us we might want to do.
All right. And you're actually asking, I mean, there's a long list of, you know, three things that could make Summit County a healthy community. Some things it just doesn't seem necessarily how the county would have anything to do with affordable health care.
Yeah, and some of the items in the list, they're tough items. They're tough things to address, and they're things that are being addressed already by our elected officials and housing, and we talk about health care. But there are certain things that at the local level, at the local public health level, we may not be able to directly influence or change, but we do have an opportunity to address them in other ways. And so when I think about healthcare and the question around healthcare, we look at, are there opportunities to make information readily available for individuals? Are there ways that we can partner better with our friends at the People's Health Clinic, or do we need to work more closely with Intermountain Health or some of our local clinics in finding ways to use grant funding to supplement high deductible insurance plans? If we at least understand the perceived risk among our community or those things that are making it difficult for people to live a happy and healthy life, really getting us to our tagline of a healthier community for all, at least we know where we stand and we're not using resources on an element or a part of our community that we think might have improvements when we're learning elsewhere that money or resource is better spent elsewhere.
Okay. As you mentioned, you do have a new website. What are some of the changes people are going to see here?
Through a third-party contractor, we determined that our old website was not very user-friendly. It was not mobile-friendly. And using the metrics that website developers use, it was performing very poorly, substandard or sub-industry standards. And really wasn't relevant. It became a repository of scattered information that was hard to find and navigate. So when we set out to do the new website or build the new website, we had three goals in mind. One is that it was clean. Two, that it was easily navigable. And three is that it became an information hub of all things public health and community health in Summit County. I believe we've achieve that. When you look at it, it's a very simple website. We learned that I think the number is more than two-thirds of individuals were accessing our website through mobile devices, and our old website became a little bit clunky. This new one is focused on a mobile device and being able to navigate that information from your phone or other tablet device. The other thing is we have tools in there that allow us to create heat maps across the pages and to track the path that people are taking through the website based on search functions and the chatbot that are available. And what that means is we can see what information people are accessing on a regular basis and how well the website is performing in terms of sharing information. That being said, the new website is also can be managed internally, meaning that as we see those heat maps develop and we find ways that, people are using the information or the website quickly and efficiently, we can modify other parts of the web page to mirror that so that that same efficiency is available to anyone using the website.
Okay, so you said it does still have some refinement?
Yeah, it's has a three-phase launch period. I will admit I am not a website developer or designer. I enjoy the benefits of the internet, but I'm not one that knows how to build a web page. And our contractor has said that this will launch in three phases. The first phase is done. Now we're building out some of the information, trying to find the broken links and areas of that there's not quite the information we'd hope it would be, and then start using those heat maps to develop into the second and then final launch or final ending phase, that third phase where everything's ready to rock and roll.
Well, I just pulled it up and I'm like, I'm looking for those skin cancer screenings and I don't see any information about that. And then went to search it and nothing comes up. So I don't, you don't really have an events page, I guess. I don't know what else you'd look under.
No, and I'm sure that the staff of the health department are listening and that's a great suggestion and that's one that we can address today.
Okay, let's see, tick awareness. What's the latest with ticks?
We're right in the middle of that tick season. If you follow us on any of our social media platforms, you're probably seeing quite a few things around ticks, ticks for your pets, ticks for us as people, your children. With it warming up and getting to that spot where we're out and about riding our bikes and hiking the hills, we're just encouraging individuals to keep a close eye on themselves, their pets, family members, everything, everybody in their household related to ticks. Anytime you've been outside, in the brush, walking around, just take a few minutes that evening before you get in the shower, before you get cleaned up, to do a tick check. Check those areas, your armpits, your groin, your backside, to make sure that you don't have a tick. You know, the diseases that ticks have are 100% preventable. Just because you have a tick bite does not mean you're gonna get sick. But if that tick is left embedded in your skin for 24 hours, then the risk increases greatly for tick-borne disease or illness. So quick tick checks every day. If you're backpacking in the Uintas and spending a day or two out there in a tent, take an evening with a flashlight, check yourself. It doesn't take more than just a few minutes, and really you can prevent any tick-borne illnesses that they present.
Okay. Hey, Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
See you next month. That's Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Well, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released its annual Kids Count data book this morning, including for the first time 50 state data on plunging test scores and surging absenteeism in our nation's public schools. In the studio to discuss this year's report, I have the CEO of Voices for Utah Children, Mo Hickey. He's joined by Martin Munoz, who serves as the organization's Kids Counts Director. He's on the phone. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, Martin, let's start with you. And maybe you just kind of give us what is this annual report that's funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation all about?
The Kids Count Project is a project funded through the Annie E. Casey Foundation with state partners throughout the United States. And we look at the well-being of children, look at economic well-being, education, health, and family and community. And overall, Utah tends to do really well, but we struggle in some areas that we could do better. And we need state leaders to really pay attention to that and see that their communities do need help still. Even though we're ranked third this year, last year we were ranked second, so we did drop. But it's a positive light, but at the same time, there are some pockets that we need to help out.
All right. So I did mention it is annual. So it does happen every year, this report?
Yes. They conduct the analysis of the data every year with other partner organizations. It's released roughly around this time of the year every year. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I mean, they look at well-being, economic well-being. I mean, are those the same every year that are looked at, so we're kind of comparing apples to apples here?
Yeah, we're looking at child poverty. We're looking at children whose parents lack secure employment, which is interesting for, you know, our state. Roughly 17% of Utah children are in families with parents who lack secure employment, which, you know, for being with Utah with such a low unemployment rate, you know, there's a concern there. You know, that's very much a concern. But then also a big one is children living in household with high housing cost burden. Utah children, roughly 23% of Utah children live in a situation like that where their family are facing high house costs.
So what were some of the surprising findings for you?
One thing I keep looking at every year in the realm of education, and this is something we also share in our local book that we produce every year as well, is children ages 3 and 4 that are not in school, in preschool. That number keeps creeping up. We've been averaging close to 60% at 58% in Utah. That's roughly, you know, 57,000 kids that we could give an extra step up in their education career. And, you know, it can make a difference this year with the national book. A big concern is 4th and 8th grade proficiency in reading and math. And Utah is struggling there. 4th graders not proficient in reading, roughly 63% of our students. And 65% of our 8th grade students are not proficient in math. And this has a huge effect on economic future possibilities.
Yeah. Any understanding about why those kids who could be in preschool aren't in preschool? I mean, is it a transportation issue? Is it just availability, cost?
I definitely believe it's availability, and then others, it's just trying to make sure we have opportunities. And I think, yeah, availability is a big concern. Trying to have it similar as we're seeing with our childcare issues as well, you know. It's just not having that availability for families for options.
Yeah. According to the report, as you mentioned, Utah ranks 3rd in the nation regarding child well-being. Actually, we're 6th in health among all the states. What does that reflect?
With health, you know, and with our, health, we're ranked 13th. We scored a 13th in our health. And we, you know, they're within the big one we look at is children without health insurance. We're doing better there. And hopefully, you know, with the work we advocated for last year with passing of covering more children without health insurance can make a difference. We're still looking at 6% of Utah kids, roughly 61,000 children that do not have access to health insurance, which then affects, you know, them getting proper care and knowing that they are being taken care of. So I think that's a huge concern. And then the other aspect in that domain is they look at the indicator, you know, teen with overweight or obesity. You know, there's still that concerns very much has a high percentage rate. So from 10 to 17-year-olds, roughly 27% are dealing with health concerns around weight. So that's something, you know, we can definitely help out on, making sure kids are getting a proper nutritious meal and then just proper education opportunities. But then also the health insurance, making sure parents have access to health insurance for their kids is just such a vital thing that we can take care of.
Digging deeper into the report, it says that these numbers are an average and may not reflect the disparities for students of color or children in immigrant families. So, I mean, if you were to dig deeper, what would you find?
Well, definitely looking at, especially with our chronic absenteeism, very much a concern. We look at, if you look deeper within the report, and you look at the data that was sent out, our Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander communities are averaging 52% that are chronically absent. And that's missing 10% of a student missing school. days. And so, and then you look at our Utah American Indian and Alaska Native students are roughly 49% are in chronic absenteeism issues. So it's trying to find out, going into those communities and asking why students are missing school and asking them, you know, what we can help with. You know, the best way to help a community is to go into the community and ask them their advice on how we can help. And I think that's a vital concern, is getting out and finding out. And I think that's one thing is Voices for Utah Children we really push is being partners with our community neighbors and other organizations that can help out in communities that are struggling.
So Matt, or Mo, as Martin kind of reeled off, you know, 63% of fourth graders not proficient in reading, 65% of eighth graders not proficient in math, 28% of Utah students chronically absent. Despite the investments being made in education, it doesn't appear to be getting better. So, I mean, what does this tell us, that money isn't the answer?
Well, the investment's a tricky question because we have always been near the bottom of investment in education. So even when we have added to that investment and we still have the youngest population in the country, it kind of just keeps getting spread. It's like, it's, you know, I'll use the governor's analogy. It's like seeding a field. You know, you're just going to spread the seed out across, but we're not really focused on truly having an impact economically on education. You know, we've been battling Idaho for 49th and 50th on an annual basis, and I think we're 49th this year, only because Idaho came in with worse policies. But even though we're making these investments in education, a lot of it is just keeping up with the demand, so to speak.
So are you able to pull out the data then from the Utah numbers for specifically Summit and Wasatch County?
Yes, we can. And I don't have the education numbers specifically. Martin might be able to pull those. I have some other numbers that I think are important for us here that are related to this. So when we talk about pre-K and childcare, Park City School District's doing a good job expanding the pre-K program for next year, so there'll be more spots available. But to give you an example, a family of four with two children in childcare in Summit County, the cost to break even is $126,098. That's with rent, food, and childcare costs. The median wage in Summit County, which is the highest in the state, is $116,351, which just by definition means 50% have less than that, which the gap is already there. When you go into Wasatch County, it gets even more difficult. Wasatch is $115,870 for a family of four to break even at this point. And these are numbers as of this week. And the median wage in Wasatch is $94,044. So a lot of what we're seeing when you look at fourth grade and eighth grade, and from my time on the school board, we talked about this years ago, pre-K has an impact. Pre-K is a preparation. It's providing the focus for the child. It's providing a safe space to learn. And Granite School District, Park City School District, Ogden School District, who expanded their pre-K programs on their own, saw better results than places that didn't have it. The other thing I'll say about the pre-K of why those children are not attending, Martine touched on accessibility. It's affordability and accessibility. One thing that's changed dramatically across the state is we used to be a state where about 38% of parents both parents were in the workforce with children under six. Now we're closing in on 60% both in the workforce. So when you have a good economy, it leads to other outcomes. So if you're in an hourly job, if you're down in Lehigh in Silicon Slopes, but you're working in a service industry, you haven't kept pace with the cost in those places. So families have to have both people in the workforce. Then it becomes a real challenge because the average cost of childcare is over $10,000 if you're under 3 years old. So are you working to just break even? You know, what are the outcomes we're seeing there?
Yeah, and I think what the school board learned long ago was that it's much less expensive. I don't want to say cheaper, but it is less expensive to catch the kids at preschool than it is to try and help them later on in their school career.
Much, much more. And I would even go further back. I was having a conversation with somebody last week who was really interested in this topic, and I said, we really have to start with prenatal. If we can start with prenatal care for expectant mothers and make sure that every prenatal expectant mother has that care, which they don't at the moment, and we follow through with that, we're going to identify issues earlier. You have trained pediatricians, trained health professionals who would identify some of these issues and be able to address them before they snowball into bigger issues. We're really concerned right now, for example, with the Medicaid unwinding. We've had one of the largest percentage drops of families being cut off from Medicaid in the country, simply because, for the most part, it's procedural. They don't have the right paperwork at the time of their appointment. We've seen over 184,000 people cut off Medicaid at the moment. And in Utah, 14.7% of our students rely on Medicaid for their insurance. So we really have to take the whole approach. We have to look at the whole situation and say, you know, are children in adequate child care? Are the parents receiving proper health care as they go into parenthood? Are the children receiving, like, getting immunized, having their health checkups, having their screenings done? Because you touched on it, and it's so important to remind, especially leadership in the state, we pay for it in some fashion. We either pay for it now or we pay for it later, and later is always more expensive.
Yeah, and you mentioned that prenatal care. What does that have to do with just brain development of the growing?
Well, it's making sure the mom's healthy, making sure that the, you know, one of the things that we've seen work really well in Utah's community health worker programs and home visitation programs. So, you know, I always say, I thought I was fairly well educated until I had a child. And then I had no clue what I was doing, right? The first time you have a child, you just don't know. So part of the prenatal is making sure of the health aspect of the, both the mother and the child, and making sure they understand, like, nutrition and what not to do, what to do. But also adding to that, if we could have more of a home visitation program like they do in some of the Nordic countries, where somebody actually goes to the house, helps out in the beginning, just to make sure everything's going smoothly and not putting the child in a risky situation, not intentionally, just because you don't know. So it's taken that approach of, it's frustrated me for years. The most important years for a child are 0 to 5. And that's where we have the least investment in the state of Utah by far.
So you've got this big book of data and facts and percentages. I mean, what do you do with it? I mean, is there some kind of meeting with the state legislature in terms of, like, you know, showing them that this is what it is and this is what we could do?
We meet with them any chance we get, which is becoming a little bit less lately. They're a little bit less transparent than they have been in the past. However, what we'd started pre-COVID and we've ramped up since then, after COVID, is going directly into the communities, as Martine mentioned. And I'll give you an example. We mapped out the change in free and reduced meals for the whole Wasatch Front about 2 years ago, and we compared 2000 to 2019 to see where poverty was changing. We then identified Ogden as a place which really is struggling, and if you go into South Ogden, it actually has worse socioeconomic factors than San Juan County, which most people think of as the worst in the state. But what we found was we had a community that wanted to help make change. We went in and sat down with the school district, the mayor's office, the larger nonprofits in town, the healthcare providers, and said, we can make change in Ogden without legislative approval if we have the willingness to do so. So we're putting together a community center in Ogden right now that's going to incorporate healthcare, childcare, and pre-K. It's going to have adult education, and it's going to have satellite offices. So if somebody needs to register for Medicaid or CHIP, or they need to have expungement, there'll be a satellite person on site. So we think we can make a lot of change locally, and people truly care about their local community.
For people who would like to learn more about the National Data Book, is it on your website at this point?
It's on our website, but I would encourage them to contact Martine directly, martine@utahchildren.org. Or they can contact me, mo@utahchildren.org. But the information is there, and we encourage people. This is the high-level publication, but we can get down pretty close to zip codes in most cases. So if anybody's interested in what's happening in 84060 as opposed to the rest of Summit County, reach out to us and we'll do our best to get that information.
Okay. Anything else that you thought we needed to add real quick?
No, I appreciate you having us on. You know, this...
Yeah, thank you.
We do try to make this a live book, meaning, you know, it doesn't go and sit on a shelf and hope for the best. We do go out to the communities. I've seen parts of Utah I never thought I'd see when I first moved here. But that's where we're really seeing the most reception to, where people have not had that support. So our rural communities really need the support and welcome us greatly when we go out there.
Okay. Mo, Martine, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, in the studio with an update from Park City Education Foundation, I have CEO Ingrid Whitley along with Vice President of Advancement, Jen Dell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start first with Running with Ed. Get a recap. How did that go, Jen?
Oh, it was fantastic. And very, very first, can we just say congratulations to the class of 2024, because graduation was Friday, and that is so exciting, and they had a beautiful evening, which is always, always great. Hats off to them. So Running with Ed, it was an awesome day. We had amazing weather, which is super rare, as you know, Leslie, beautiful in the 60s. We had 1,000 runners, which was fantastic. The race went smoothly, no accidents or emergencies that we knew of. So we were really happy about that. Great finish party put on by our sponsors at the end. And we broke our fundraising goal. So our goal was $325,000. And we ended up raising $340,000. So a huge, huge shout out to our community and sponsors, of which KPCW is one, for making sure that's a huge success, because that is how we fund our classroom grants.
Right. And so that's actually raised through registration, but people also do individual fundraising, and which kind of takes you over.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So that peer-to-peer fundraising, so every runner, when they register, a fundraising page is automatically created for them. You don't have to fundraise, but we hope you do. And yeah, over about 140 people did do fundraising, and then maybe another 15 just donated to the race. But so those folks, you know, they raised anywhere from $25 to thousands of dollars. Our top student fundraiser was a first grader who raised just under $2,000. And he did it by selling golf balls. He went and picked up old golf balls on the sides of the fairways and greens and washed them and then sold them. And he raised just under $2,000, which was amazing.
Yeah. How many people actually ran alone? Do you know?
Oh, that's a great question. I did not hear specifically about anyone running the whole thing. Typically, we have 1 to 3 people who might run the whole thing, but I don't know that anyone did this year.
Okay. Well, as Jen mentioned, Ingrid, that $340,000 now kind of goes into the classroom grants funding.
That's right.
But this year, you just awarded the grants, but that's from last year's fundraising?
Yes. So this year's fundraising goes to support next year's classroom grant awards. And our board just voted on the grant committee's recommendations at our May 23rd meeting and approved over $265,000 in grant awards that goes directly into our schools to support 35 programs, which is really exciting. Thank you to the community for supporting.
Yeah, well, tell us about then some of those 35 grants.
Yeah, so many, so I can't name them all, but a couple that I just wanted to call out that have a kind of a special place in my heart. So I was a theater kid, so I love that one of the grants we support funds the Park City High School theater program. I just know how transformative theater can be for kiddos. And then as a former educator, I just remember how important it is to inspire literacy among our students. And so I was excited to see the grant committee suggest our support for a program called Book Break, and that will be at all the elementary schools and Ecker as well, which is a new innovative program that offers monthly live or recorded author visits with students, which is really exciting. So just two of the many, but really exciting programs that we get to support within the schools. And all of these come from grant applications that teachers, educators in the district submit to us.
Yeah, I mean, what was the biggest grant award amount?
Probably for that orchestra program,
yeah.
I would say. So this year, the biggest awards were $25,000, and that program, I think, was 20. Now, I will say, so the RC Club, which you might have heard of, the Remote Control Club, that's an free after-school club that is at three of our four elementary schools where students build RC remote control cars. So they're learning designing, coding, working together collaboratively. And then there's a big race at the end of the school year. That one costs about $10,000 per school. And next year, it's going to also expand to Jeremy Ranch. So it's been so popular that all four schools will do that. So altogether, that's about $40,000. But it's $10,000 per school.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, do you offer any kind of multi-year grants, or do you require teachers to come back in every year and apply?
That is an excellent question that we will be working on in strategic planning next year. So right now, you do need to reapply every year in the classroom grant space. Some of our programs are three-year programs, so like EVA, Elementary Visual Arts, or the preschool and after school. Mm-hmm. We commit to 3 years at a time for those. But classroom grants are every single year. And Leslie, I know you're familiar with debate, LIA, robotics. So there is a lot of conversation about, do we need to really ask for that application every single year? Could it be every 3 years? So that's a great question, and we'll be figuring that out over the next year.
All right. So, I mean, of that $340,000 that was raised, how much of that will actually go back into grants? I mean, it's not every dollar, doesn't sound
no, because
like.
It costs us about $100,000 to put on the race now. So about $250,000 will go back to classroom grants and maybe a little more if our fundraising this year when it all shakes out. You know, if we had a great parent appeal and Red Apple Gala, we can look at those numbers too.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Bright Futures class of 2024. Maybe just tell us what it is and how many you had actually participate.
Absolutely. So Bright Futures is our program where we're walking alongside these amazing, motivated, and dedicated first-generation students. So they're students who are the first in their families to go to college or get a secondary degree. We start with them in 10th grade and work with them all the way through college graduation, which is fairly unusual for a K-12 public education foundation to continue on past 12th grade. So what we were finding is that even just beyond financial, the support needed once these students got to college needed to continue. So our second cohort graduated, seven students graduated from college this year. So that's very exciting. She's going to be doing her student teaching next semester. She really hopes to come back to Park City and teach, so she might be your student's teacher. One student is working. He got a job with JP Morgan Chase in San Francisco as an analyst. So a lot of excitement there. And some are taking, you know, a semester off and then going to figure out what they want to do next. And then there were 21 students who graduated from Park City High on Friday. And almost all of those are going on to college. I think one is taking a mission. And so they're going on to college. Very exciting to have that big class. FAFSA, I think a lot of people heard, if you had a student this year, that is the form you fill out to get financial aid in different ways. The government changed that, and it was kind of a mess. And so that has impacted our students. And so we are working really hard to figure out their financial aid packages without the help of FAFSA at this moment. We're hoping they'll get it figured out by the time they get to college, because that financial aid package is really important.
Sure. So of that seven students that graduated from college this year, that second cohort, I mean, how many did you start with? I mean, I know life happens, things change.
Right. Right. So in that class, I believe we started, typically the classes start at about 20. You know, COVID happened in there. And the other thing you have to remember is when we first started with Bright Futures, we only had one part-time person working, and that was Rebecca Gonzalez. And she was going to school full-time and working part-time. And so what we realized over these last 8 years is we really do need staff. So we have three full-time staff member. But as, again, life happens, and as students, you know, perhaps had to move on into working, that happened.
Yeah, but I'm guessing you hope for a better than 30% graduation rate.
Yeah, absolutely. So once kids got into college, we have 80% progression rate. So they're staying, you know, which nationally is 11%. So it's still a lot better than the national rate.
And there's still a few students working through year five or year six to get
yes.
their degrees. So not all students will graduate in 4 years, and we continue to support them during those maybe extra years they need to finish school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't take 4 years. Yes. Either.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm about out of time. Anything else you want to mention?
I just want to say thank you to all the donors who supported us this year. We are at the end of our fiscal year, the end of June. And if you haven't had a chance to make a gift this year, you can go to PCEF4kids.org. And we'd be really grateful for any last minute gifts that can come in to support our work. So thanks to all our donors.
Okay. Ingrid Whitley, Jennifer Bellow, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.